and welcome to Myth Matters, storytelling and conversation about mythology and why myth matters to your life today. I'm your host and personal mythologist, Dr. Catherine Svela. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, you are part of this story circle. This is Just to Say by William Carlos Williams. I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet, and so cold. I hear the echoes of another meeting with a tempting fruit in that poem. Maybe an apple in a garden long ago? Perhaps you hear it too. The shared roots of myth and poetry are very deep. They reach down into the oldest layers of psyche. And since April is National Poetry Month here in the United States, today we're going to explore the relationship between soul, poetry, and what C.G. Jung called the symbolic life. I say we because we have a special guest today. I've invited my colleague and friend, Brian Michael Tracy, to join me and add his insights into this multidimensional theme. Brian and I originally met some years ago through a shared appreciation for Joseph Campbell and for poetry. He is a fellow myth lover and soul seeker, a quarter of the muse, and a poet and songwriter. Thank you so much, Brian, for taking the time out to do this podcast.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I look forward to our conversation and to the topic, as you say, being in Poetry Month here in the United States. I think it's apropos, and I look forward to reading some poems and discussing mythology and the art of the symbolic life.
There are so many different ways to approach our topic. I thought we'd begin with the tagline on your website, Brian. Art is the informed translation of soul. So much is contained in those few words. What does that mean in your mind? Art is the informed translation of soul.
That's a really good question. I would say that it has to do with presence. It has to do with being in touch, with listening. I think the word informed is important there also. I think that's part of it. You know, it's that's part of what the unpacking the word informed is having a presence, taking the time to listen to the whispers of the soul. And if we do that, whether on our own or with a prompt or by reading someone else's poem, or reading a myth, then we're starting to approach that.
I sense that the art or creative process is a conversation between the consciousness of the creator, the poet, the songwriter, the artist, the dreamer, and what's coming from a different place in the psyche.
I mean, I can speak from the point of view of the artist. It's a mining of and a mindfulness to the part of us that I think we all share that Jung called the collective unconscious. And to start to make that conscious, to try and make a conscious effort to turn that into an art object or a symbol.
You used the phrase whispers of the soul a moment ago. Is there anything specific that you find yourself responding to most of the time?
It varies, of course. I would say at the beginning when I really started to write seriously, quote unquote, it was a feeling like something was emerging, you know, and I needed to pay attention to it. Now, I feel like if I hear a phrase or a word, lately it's been those kind of catchphrases or words.
I'd like for you to read some of your poetry as we talk, Brian. I don't want to explain the poems or try to necessarily connect the dots between them and the flow of our conversation, but we're talking about kind of abstract stuff. And in a lot of ways, it's easier to get across in the actual poems themselves. I heard a whisper of soul when I read your poem titled The Story of Light. Would you mind reading that one first?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. It's an interesting introduction to this one. Speaking of how these things happen, there's a Sting song, and I forget the name of it right here off the top of my head, but has a phrase in it called sad, shy horses walking home in the sodium light. And I always mistook sodium for story of light. And I love that phrase, but I could never find a poem to go with it. And I carried it for years. And then finally, I was putting a collection together and I came up with this called The Story of Light. You are disappointed, I know, the way the leaves fail the trees and the snow covers your heart in winter. But tonight, as you stare into yet another storm, imagine the eye and remember how morning, like innocence, returns each day to you, and how soon the fields will shimmer once again, your horses dancing before they run, overcome by the emotion of sunlight. True, the fences you have built no longer hold, but you take pleasure in knowing there is nothing more to do. The sun goes down, the horses return. Tonight, though, the only sound is the sound of an open gate groaning against the wind. And the only light is the light from the snow falling, immortal, dissolving as it reaches your heart. And you, standing at your gate, are nothing more or less than its story.
I love the way that ends. And you know, we're talking about responding to things. And that happens in those of us who find a poem as well. I could try to offer an elegant, well-thought-out reason for my attraction to that poem, and yet it's the images of the horses, plain and simple. Certain images of horses take me to a particular state of mind.
Well, you know what the horse symbolizes, right?
I can think of a number of ways to answer that question. What's your intention in putting the horse in this poem?
It's my understanding that the horse represents the unconscious.
Beautiful. I also think of animal vitality, of our life, our drive below the surface of what it is we think that we're doing.
What we think we're doing. Huh?
Yeah. Do we know? Do we really know? Brian, do you feel like you're in conversation then with a poem, that you're being led in some way?
Very much so. You know, we talked a minute ago about what, you know, like a catchphrase or something that might trigger, you know, a thought or a metaphor or an idea for an expression of a poem. Once the poem starts or the song lyrics start, then it's a conversation, then the poem or the song starts to take on its own life, you know, like a child, you know, where, and you just, you know, you can nudge it, you can cajole it, you can, you know, suggest things, but it's kind of becomes its own, you know, living and breathing thing. And so that's also part of the idea of paying attention to, you know, what is it that I'm trying to express, but also what is it that I've started to create, and how is that speaking to me in some way, to pay attention to that? It's very much a dialectic.
Yes, a dialectic. Listening to you, I'm reminded of something that Jung said about the symbolic life, which was his phrase for this dialectic. He said, it's a conversation between psyche and the daily ego consciousness. And one benefit is that it gives the ego perspective, because you realize, it realizes, that conscious orientation, that it's not the only component in a person or situation.
Well, yeah, no, I've read that and I've heard that. The best way I can express it is to say not to overthink it. I spent a fair amount of my adult life trying to capture a certain level of Zen, if you will, in a general sense of that word, whether it's hiking or losing yourself in sports, or for many years I played tennis. All you think about really is that ball. You're just focusing on the ball. I've enjoyed the space that can be found when the monkey brain is quiet, right? And so for me, that's a kind of a harmony to be achieved. And it's really in those spaces that that I find that I do the best creating. So I don't worry about the idea of an ego or not an ego at that time. It's just if I'm in that space, I mean, I can start writing a poem and I can look up and 3 hours have gone by and it feels like 15 minutes.
Time stops. You touch the eternal in the time-bound realm, as Campbell might say, losing that conscious sense of self in the act.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like sleeping too, right? I mean, you fall asleep and you wake up and it's, you know, however many hours later, it doesn't feel like it was, you know, it doesn't feel like the same 8 hours that you were awake. It feels like it goes by much faster. And so I think that dream state is very interesting. And of course, dreams, and Freud wrote his interpretation of dreams, and he talked about the compression that takes place with imagery. And a lot of that's in poetry and in symbols.
This sounds like a good place to stop and read another poem. Bryant, you have one that's dedicated to Jerry Garcia. It's a kind of conversation with him. Will you please read it?
I will just add one thing. Chautauqua is mentioned in the poem. It's kind of this roving band of music gypsies that would go all over the countryside and perform for people, kind of like this roving circus of musicians. They used to call it Chautauqua. Jerome, dedicated to the life and music of Jerome Jerry Garcia. What say you? We sneak in our socks through the empty cathedral, lit as it is by the late afternoon, seeping through stained glass, and place a candle at its altar. Find our shoes and sleep until the summer stars come out. Climb the bell tower, play our guitars and watch as the music moves down the street, through the trees, into our yards, swirling like the skirts of gypsies when they dance and snap their fingers in the air. What say you? We take our horses, let out the leads, and race to the Chautauqua. Pitch our tents against the trees and sing songs under an open sky with words that seem to spill from fire, scorching the landscape like lava on its way to the sea. There they meet the tide and claim the shoreline. What say you? We ride to the cliffs above the harbor, to the unmarked trail between days. There the muses poured the blue liquid of eternal tones into a guitar. Pick it up. Bring it to your ear. Strum it. It is light. Strum it again. It is night. Strum it again, and the unmarked trail is gone. So too the horses.
There are those horses again. Brian, what do you derive from the process of writing a poem about and to a person whom you've never met?
Right. Well, having listened to just about everything that Jerry put on, you know, vinyl, and going to a lot of concerts, I think one feels when one is drawn into another person's art, or another person's personality, even if it's from a distance, that somehow obviously there's been a meeting, right? There's been a connection. And to me, I will tell you what I was trying to do was, I think, two things, maybe semi-consciously. One, if you notice, the poem is an invitation. What say you? And so I always felt that way about the music. I always felt like it was an invitation. Jerry called it a signpost to new space. which is what I think art does for us, gives us a signpost to new space. And I think the other thing was just trying to capture somehow the emotional enrichment that I felt through the music.
I found out about the Dead fairly late and didn't make it to a show until very near the end. I think it was the last show they played in Las Vegas. And I remember part of me thinking, thank God I didn't find out about them earlier, because I was ready to just get in my car and say, where are we going next?
That's it. And by contrast, I was 15 years old when I went to my first show. And I had no friends that told me about it. I was simply drawn to the cover of their album, Speaking of Symbols, Anthem of the Sun. And I was drawn into it like I was sucked into a vortex. And I was in the middle of a department store. And I lost, for a moment, all sense of time and space. And so I took that album and I asked my mother if she would buy it for me. And she did. And that was it. I was 15 years old. And 6 months later, they were playing at the Boston Music Hall. And as I had an opportunity to tell Phil Lesh one time when I met him, the bassist in the Grateful Dead, I said life was never the same after that.
I'm glad you told that story. It's so important that we allow experiences like that to be significant, that we let ourselves be grabbed. I talk to quite a few people who want to be more connected to their self, to their soul life, and to a deeper sense of purpose, maybe what Campbell called their bliss. But there's so much preoccupation with what you think it should look like, or what you think is important or will be important to you. We often miss the signs and the signals that we give ourselves that come from these deeper levels of being, deeper levels of psyche.
Yes, I wrote a poem about that.
Wonderful. Is that one you can read for us?
It's called The Wings of Blackbirds. And it's from my second collection. The Distance Between Shores is the name of the book. The Wings of Blackbirds. Come, let us measure the distance between shores. For if we measure the distance between shores, we may become the wings of blackbirds. Feel the acrid wind release us from the salty mist, the empty rooms of our lighthouse, where we pace the floors, warming our hands with rosaries and rhinestones. Fly to the cliffs where the tides keep our graves and flowers fade and death's impatient vase. Come, let us find new wind, new colors of the wind, green, wind full of tears from the eyes of children mourning the landscape. Gold, wind that turns tears into snow above our wings. White, wind that whispers to the child, hush, do not cry. Your soul is a lullaby singing to me. White, let us fly into white. White hills, white rivers, white water on the sea. White ash when we return, white ash when we leave. White flowers in the snow, snow that mourns the child. Birds that mourn the flowers, ash that fills the vase. Come, let us sail with the sound of wind and listen to the tenor of the tides, the songs of our children inside our sails. Take the ocean to our lips and play as if it were a saxophone, as if we were drowning, as if the moon was all that could float, without wind, without wings.
You offered this in response to our conversation about listening to our own messages and the signals we give ourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about how this shows up in this poem without doing violence to the mystery of the poem?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So again, of course, it's a kind of an invitation, right? Come, So let us measure the distance between shores. So what is the distance between shores? We could view that as a distance between our conscious life and our unconscious life. You know, how do we bridge that? But the acrid wind is blowing, the salty mist. We're warming our hands with rosaries and rhinestones. You know, maybe that's not the answer. Maybe the rosaries and the rhinestones aren't the answer. So let us find new wind. Let us endeavor to find new wind, new colors of the wind, and so forth. So it's that kind of invitation to explore. That's what made me think of this poem when you're talking about, you know, how do we find something a little deeper, maybe?
An invitation to explore. That's really elegant. Your conscious intention with these images in the poem. How much of this are you aware of when you write the poem? And then follow-up question for people who might be feeling like they can't write a poem. How necessary do you think it is to really understand what you're handling when you begin writing?
Well, I read one time that the best results are for an artistic endeavor when one has about a 40% idea. 40% of what one is up to. A little less might be a little too fuzzy, a little more too conscious. So I was trying to find a metaphor for this idea of bridging the conscious and the unconscious. And a lot of myth talks about the shore, the ferryman. Again, you can go back to the Grateful Dead, whether that's true death. I mean, to me, that was always death and rebirth, right? So the ferryman is that kind of bringing you across to the other shore for that, or the shedding of skin and then the rebirth. So that idea that we should measure that distance, you know, how far do we have to go? You know, what is that distance between shores? What does it really mean? It could be a 1 second travel distance. It could be an eternity. Travel distance. It could be a lifetime. So that was my start, the idea of measuring the distance between shores. And that started the whole poem. And then it just went from there. But in terms of what one has to be that conscious of, I think one just has to have a strong feeling that they want to write something down. That's all.
I don't write much poetry. I make visual art. And returning to something that you said earlier, most of the time that I do something that I like, it moves me in a particular way. At some point in my process, I might try to understand that or develop it in a way that I think will make the experience a bit more universal, but it starts off as very personal. Does it zing me in some way?
I mean, I think it almost has to. There are stories of people that start to do things when they become successful for audiences that they think they have, or in order to maintain their success. And of course, you know, that loses its truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's manufactured. You know, you're producing something that is somewhat artificial at that point in time. And I think people can sense that. You know, I think part of what people are looking for is some level of genuineness. And then of course, some idea of identity. You know, it's what do I identify with? You know, yeah. One reads a novel or a poem. What parts of it do I identify with? And I think that's what Jung was getting at with the symbolic life as well, which is kind of a fulfillment of identity.
I would use the word soul to describe the thing that's missing from what's not satisfying, what feels too superficial or canned or plotted or bloodless or whatever. There are lots of ways to describe it, but I think that when we experience some creative process or some creative product and it's just blank, that's a good way to describe what is missing. No soul. I find all of this interesting, what a person follows and how much you have to know from another angle, which is the deep connection I have with poems that I didn't write myself. I can have a version of this soul conversation this art as the informed translation of soul experience. When I'm in conversation with something that didn't originate out of my personal consciousness. Bryant, do you read other people's poetry much?
Yes, for sure. Absolutely. Again, early on in my teens, I somehow stumbled upon Wallace Stevens, who I consider to be one of the premier 20th century American poets. And I read his poem Sunday Morning, and the hair on my arms and back of my neck just stood up. I mean, it was just so powerful to me. And that is, you know, in the nutshell, the power of art. In that case, it was a poem. And of course, I went on from there to read almost everything he ever wrote.
I'd like to read a poem that I read pretty much every day for most of the last year, 2020, the year of COVID. And I think you have a poem that's in conversation with this one, Brian. So maybe you can read that when I get done. This poem is called The Mystery of Meteors by Eleanor Learman. I am out before dawn, marching a small dog through a meager park. Boulevards angle away. Newspapers fly around like blind white birds. 2 days in a row, I have not seen the meteors, though the radio news says they are overhead. Leonid's brimstones are barred by clouds. I cannot read the signs in heaven. I cannot see night rendered into fire. And yet I do believe a net of glitter is above me. You would not think I still knew these things. I get on the train, I buy the food, I sweep, discuss, consider gloves or boots, and in the summer, open windows, find beads to string with pearls. You would not think that I had survived anything but the life you see me living now. In the darkness, the dog stops and sniffs the air. She has been alone. She has known danger. And so now she watches for it always, and I agree with the conviction of my mistakes. But in the second part of my life, slowly, slowly, I begin to counsel bravery. Slowly, slowly, I begin to feel the planets turning, and I am turning toward the crackling shower of their sparks. These are the mysteries I could not approach when I was younger. The boulevards, the meteors, the deep desires that split the sky. Walking down the paths of the cold park, I remember myself, the one who can wait out anything. So I caution the dog to go silently, to bear with me the burden of knowing what spins on and on above our heads. For this is our reward. Come Armageddon, come fire or flood, come love, not love, millennia of portents. There is a future in which the dog and I are laughing. Born into it, the mystery. I know we will be saved. Now, when I first started reading this poem, there were a couple of obvious attractors, like the use of the word Armageddon, given what was going on in the time that I found this poem. And this note of mystery, you know, my tagline is keep the mystery in your life alive. Over time and multiple readings, I've realized that the theme I hear of an unseen order in things is deeply comforting to me. You know, the constellations are up there. I can't see them. It's cloudy, but they are there. The boulevards are angling. I'm walking on one street and the trash is blowing around. But if I was able to view them from a different perspective, I would be able to see the pattern. When I got that insight, I really fell into a place of comfort with this poem. I used it to remind myself that I believe in this order, which led me to think about a comment that Jeanette Peri made when I was at Pacifica. She said that sometimes we need to borrow the words of others to express our own experience. We do something very personal that is also communal and has value to the community. And this is a core function of culture.
Well, yes, communicating on a deeper level, right? So, yeah, you're using her words. She's using your words. We're using a common language to communicate on a deeper level. And one of the things that I love about that poem, there are many things I love about that poem, but one of the things I really enjoy is the everyday tasks that she talks about that she's doing with her dog or by herself. It's so tangible and a very daily thing, you know, string beads and so forth. And yet this, all this is moving around me, and you would think that I would not be in touch with it. You know, you would think because the cloud is there, whatever the cloud might be, right? The veil of ignorance that might be another phrase for it, if one's a Buddhist or not, or just understands that phrase, but there might be this veil of ignorance, but maybe there's not, you know, and in seeing, in an understanding, as you put it, the unseen order of things, because maybe you've experienced it once before. I think it was Hillman's quote, something to the effect that in order to see the angel, you must first have a glimpse of it or an idea of it in order to see the angel. And so once you've had a glimpse of that, then you have a sense of this unseen order, and you can come back to it. And however you find that, maybe it's through art, maybe it's through a dream, maybe it's through a conversation with a friend.
I like that connection between the glimpse, the idea or image, and then the trust that whatever was glimpsed continues to exist. Thank you for that. How about another poem? You have one titled Astrology, right? Does that feel like the one to read now?
I think so. Thank you. So yes, the title of this poem is Astrology, and has a quote by Tycho Brahe. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. One of the very first astronomers. You know, as we matured in our intellectual development, in our brain development, one reads history. We move from mere astrology into astronomy. By looking up, I see downward. Astrology. If I could pour myself like rain into a cradle, waiting, or squeeze like cheese through the eye of a needle, I would lie down, fall upward in half integers of time, rest my head on a cloud and watch the stars live their lives, watch them appear and disappear, arrange and rearrange, asymmetrical, misaligned, and connect them as dots, searching always for the face of God. I would close my eyes and listen to soft cries cascade over me as they turn themselves into white dwarfs the size of sugar cubes, put them in my tea, and watch them dissolve, spilling over the edge of my cup, past the ends of my table, spreading like wind, like the sound of wind, over yards and fields, forest and ocean, never falling, simply bending as light does, like prayer when it reaches the horizon, seeking the shortest path home.
Seeking the shortest path home.
I loved your phrase about the unseen order of things. And so this is kind of that, it's almost like this, the flip side of that coin. You know, the other side of that coin of the unseen order of things is man's desire to look up there and say, watch them arrange and rearrange the stars, right? Asymmetrical, misaligned. But as a human, I'm going to connect them as dots, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going to turn them into constellations and I'm going to give them meaning, right? That's what we did. But really underneath it all, we're searching for the phrase that I used was the face of God.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you can look at the sky and you can see, you can say it's random, but that human impulse to connect them and say, oh, that's Orion's belt, or that's the Big Dipper, or, you know, et cetera. And so that was that interplay for me in that poem of man's desire for order and understanding, but really ultimately meaning.
Seeing connections and patterns, finding the messages, making meaning, that is what we do. It's that narrative consciousness. And actually, it's that imaginative aspect of consciousness, which is the core of James Hillman's definition of soul. And it's really fluid, isn't it? It's continuously creating and elaborating.
Well, meaning doesn't have to be a permanent meaning, right? That's the other part of it, right? So you know, meaning can all evolve.
I think recognizing and allowing for this evolution of meaning is an important part of understanding the creative process as an informed translation of soul, you know, listening to those whispers and letting yourself be led. Have you experienced this evolution in meaning in any of your poems, Brian, in a way that you could share with us?
Yes, and it's a poem that I probably could best leave everybody with because it does speak to that point of, I guess, not being able to step in the water, the same water twice, that kind of thing. When I come back to this poem, it means something a little different to me each time. It's interesting because this is an unpublished poem, and maybe there's a reason for that, I don't know. But it's called Coastal Plush. Would you like me to read it?
Yes, please.
Coastal Plush. From this white stone veranda, you can sit and watch the waves roll for hours in mesmerizing shades of blue and green until the late afternoon when the fog begins its climb along the hills of the Pacific. Inside, Vivaldi plays, and a man sits alone writing at his desk, filling his days with language. Dropping his pen, removing his glasses, he walks out to the veranda and surrenders to the cool coastal plush as it settles on his skin. Out here, there's no imagination that is not touched by the mist, no music that cannot be found in the movement of the tides, no word that cannot be set adrift like some dream to another shore. So come, now is the time. The waves are calling. Let us walk together down to the water's edge and speak of the poems inside our days, and the moon that never seems to set inside our nights, using as its light our memories and our dead. Let us linger in the shallow pools of the tides, shoes and socks in hand, jeans rolled to our knees, and watch the mist rise to feed the hills. Then, at dusk, build a fire bold enough to challenge the night. And in the morning, when we wake to the solemn cries of the beach gulls, we will search among the seaweed and the driftwood for our words, that we might set sail upon them behind the winds from this seductive shoreline, and find, for ourselves, once again, a new horizon.
A new horizon. Elegant metaphor right there for the continuous opening up of new possibilities. So, Brian, what's the backstory of evolving meaning for you with this poem?
At first, it was written for a professor that I met at Pacifica, who was retiring. And we would spend time out in his backyard, looking out at the ocean and talking. And so I wrote it for him when he retired from Pacifica. I went up to his retirement party. And I read it there. And it still has that underlying meaning for me. I mean, that was the intention. But the idea that out here, there's no imagination that is not touched by the mist, no music that cannot be found in the movement of the tides. And then let us walk together, which is what I feel like you and I are doing here. today, this afternoon. We're walking together. We're speaking of the poems inside our days. And the moon that never seems to set inside our nights. You know, the moon doesn't have its own light. It uses the light from the sun. And so here the phrase is, the moon using as its light our memories and our dead. And so how all of that runs through us all the time. You know, we are the million-year-old people, men and women, as Jung would say. So that is that kind of that constant shift for me of what is the poem inside your day? You know, what lights your unconscious, I guess. And so each time I come back to this poem, I find something a little different in it.
There's such a lovely sense of invitation in your poetry. And you've noted that a number of the poems that you've read are actually invitations. I want to say thank you again, Brian, for accepting my invitation to join me here. It's been really wonderful to hear some of your poems and explore through them the relationship between art, poetry, mythology, soul, and the symbolic life. To take a few minutes here to consider your phrase, art is the informed translation of soul. I'm going to be meditating on that for a while.
That's part of the beauty of it. The depth of the topics that we're covering. And I want to thank you for the invitation, Catherine, to participate. It's been a real pleasure. It's been wonderful to revisit some of these poems that I haven't read in quite a while and to have a chance to talk about them, to talk about process with you. So thank you very much.
And that's it for me, Catherine Savela and Myth Matters. Poetry and the soul life, my friends. I hope that you found some inspiration and aid for your own reflection and creative process today. To learn more about Brian and his work, please visit brianmichaeltracy.com or check out his poetry and music page on Facebook. I will post links to both of these sites on my website at mythicmojo.com. A big welcome to the new subscribers, and a huge, huge thank you to the Myth Matters supporters and patrons on Patreon. Wonderful people like Fred Burke and Julia Arrett make this podcast possible through their monthly contributions. If you are finding value in Myth Matters, I hope that you'll join them, because a few dollars goes a long way, my friends. Thank you so much for listening. Happy myth making, and keep the mystery in your life alive.